tonight for the topic, I wanted to just share a little bit about, this is my first time back, I've been gone for a month, a little bit about my retreat experience, and I really wanted to speak about, you know, for me personally, why I do this, why I'm interested in Buddhist practice and why I continue, you know, to meditate and to go on retreats and to be involved in a Buddhist community. I was on a 20-day silent meditation retreat. And so, you know, for some of us, we've sat retreats before. Some of us, that sounds absolutely insane, you know. And it's very common in this tradition, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, really in general, in all of the different schools of Buddhism, to sit meditation retreats. In the suttas, in the early discourses that the Buddha taught, were shown that it was very common because the disciples of the Buddha, the monks, were wanderers. They would wander to different villages and towns. They would retreat for about 3 months, and they called it the rains retreat. So they would go to a stable location for a period of time, and they would practice cultivating and developing mindfulness for those 3 months. So I was just doing that for 3 weeks, and I just came back this past week, and we had a big conference this weekend, and it really feels like a homecoming to me, you know, not really for me, but it feels like a homecoming to me, you know. I feel like I'm coming home. And one of the things that I really benefit from going on retreat is this, and the Buddha talks a lot about this, is this idea of seclusion, of getting away, right, for a period of time. And I often, if anything, in the most simple form from a retreat, just get a sense of perspective. Right? Going somewhere for a period of time, sitting quietly, and returning back to the, you know, same general environment. We're such creatures of habit. You know, our routines and the structure of our lives and who we talk to and what we do on a daily basis and where we eat, these are things that we don't oftentimes consider. And I don't actually, from a Buddhist perspective, habit's not a bad thing. I would say that the Buddhists would have this general sense that happiness or contentment or liberation or awakening, in a sense, is a collection of good habits. It's the development of skillful behaviors, right? Skillful speech, skillful states of mind. But our habits can also be our routines. Our habits can also be limiting. And so to be able to break out of that temporarily has been really enlightening, you know, to see, to come back and to re-examine what's important to me, what do I want to focus my attention on now that I'm coming back. I think it's just in sharing on the topic of why I do this, I want to share a little bit about my experience in coming to this path of practice. I don't do this a lot here. I'm more of a kind of buy the book, give a topic, let's talk about it type of person. But it's important to do because there's something about sharing an experience with community that can be, for me, encouraging or inspiring, or at least something that I can resonate and connect with. And so my story of coming into the Dharma and exploring Buddhist practices was that I got clean from drugs and alcohol when I was 18 years old. I started using hard drugs, crack cocaine and methamphetamine, from the time I was 15 or 16. You know, and I had a really challenging way of dealing with my childhood. I had some things happen and just a series of events. And there's a guy named Mario Martinez, and he says that oftentimes human beings have one of three primary wounding experiences in their life that affect them. And these are abandonment, betrayal, and shame. And so for me, I actually had these three experiences one after another. I found out my mom was cheating on my dad, which was a betrayal experience. My dad left us and, you know, moved to a different house. I mean, he didn't stop talking to us, but my mom and dad split. And there wasn't any discussion about it. It was just the way that it was. So there was this feeling of abandonment. And then right after that, I was getting in physical fights and being bullied at school every day for seventh grade. So there was this almost like sense of, you know, why are people beating me up? Why are people picking on me? This shame that started to manifest for me. And really, for a lot of us, that's all it takes. I can't point to anything else in my life that was overly traumatic, or it was just a series of experiences that as a young teenager, I just didn't know how to handle that. I didn't know what to do with those feelings, and I wanted a way out. And so I found refuge. I found a safe place in drugs and alcohol. First of all, it made me feel better. It's one of the most effective ways to manage stress in the short term is to get high. Because literally, getting high provides dopamine, which increases your serotonin levels, makes you feel happy. And it provides norepinephrine, which decreases your discomfort and pain and your ability to have access to some of the sadness and loneliness and shame and betrayal and abandonment. So you don't have to feel or can kind of numb out to those experiences. And it's very effective. It's very quick and works really well. And then there was this whole social component that I really found and took refuge in. And so I like to say that drugs and alcohol really saved my life, actually. I don't know what I would have done without that. I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for the people that introduced me to drugs and alcohol at that time in my life. So, you know, I fast forward through all of the addiction history and story. A lot of folks that come here are in recovery. Some aren't. From a Buddhist perspective, we're kind of in recovery. We're all in recovery from something, right? I ended up getting in a lot of trouble, having a lot of actual consequences, external consequences in my life. I got kicked out of 2 schools. I ended up getting arrested. I got 3 felonies. I went in front of the judge, and they said, okay, you can go to treatment, or you can take the risk and go to your next hearing, and maybe you'll go to like a young guy's prison camp for a year. And so I said, well, I'm going to go to treatment. And I asked my drug dealer where I should go, and he said, well, you should go to Nashville. I've been to this treatment center before. It's really good. They give you Valium to detox, which is kind of nice. They have good food. And so I took him up on that. I actually told my mom to change. She had another place in mind. I said, no, I want to go. Okay. He's really excited about rehab. So, you know, I went and I ended up in Nashville. And again, there was this big shift for me. It's like everything that I identified with and everything that really saved me, I was, in a sense, leaving behind temporarily. So who was I now without my identity in drug and alcohol addiction? I didn't really feel like I had any sense of, which is important for human beings, I didn't have any sense of identity or community. I moved here and I got clean, and you know, day after day I really focused on my recovery, and I eventually relapsed right around the corner. I got fed up, overwhelmed. And I went out, and in one night, I experienced probably some of the most traumatic or drastic change in my environment in just one night. I got kicked out of the place that I was staying. I was working with people in recovery, so I was going to get fired from my job. I saw someone get shot in the parking lot of the motel that I was staying at that night, and I ran out of money. I called my folks the next morning, and they said, we can't help you anymore. Figure it out. And so out of this desperation, I said, all right, well, I know some people in recovery because I've been clean for a couple months, so I'm just going to call them up and say, you know, help me out, give me a place to stay. And I did that, and I stayed clean day after day. And, you know, for 4 or 5 years, it was really, my emphasis was focused on, they say in the recovery program I'm in, that self-esteem is built by doing esteemable acts. So the emphasis is, if you act in ways that you feel good about, you'll in turn feel better. You'll do better. Again, this comes back to this Buddhist idea, I think, of happiness as a collection of good habits. So I really focused on my actions for these 4 or 5 years. I stopped being as dishonest. I stopped stealing or really trying to consciously not manipulate as much. I tried to practice more skillfully around sexuality. I tried to work on not sleeping around with people and being honest with my sexuality, with my partner. You know, and so I really worked, and then I stayed clean. I worked on just cleaning up. In Buddhist practice, we call the sila, or these ethical trainings. And I found that years later, years into this process, I did have a greater sense of esteem. You know, I felt good enough about myself, but I did not feel good. I struggled with chronic depression. I'd wake up and have to just get myself out of bed, and I had no sense of meaning or purpose, and I had great friends. I was doing good work. There was nothing I could point to in my life that was the reason of why I felt so bad. Yeah, every day I got up and I just felt like it was a battle to get through that day. And I would do it the next day, and I'd do it the next day. I'd call my friends and they'd have to talk me down from a ledge every day. And I kind of came to this place where I was like, all right, either this is going to change, I'm going to kill myself, relapse, or this has to change. That's really the only two options. Because I had felt like sacrificed so much, you know, to really commit to a path of recovery and still felt miserable. And at the time I called this guy I knew from being around recovery, his name was Dave. And he had started this meditation group. He was a cool guy. He had tattoos. We always would talk about music because both him and I played music. And I worked at a treatment center that he worked at for a period of time. And I knew that he practiced meditation. I'd always been interested in Buddhism. And I gave him a call and I asked if he would come to my work. I worked for myself and do a meditation with me. I didn't know really what that meant, but I wanted to give it a try. He told me, well, there's this place, this center that he teaches once a week at, and I could come on Sunday and practice. And I showed up, and I remember sitting down for the first meditation and feeling such an intense amount of fear that the whole time, and really this lasted for like a month, the whole meditation experience for me was just seeing if I could sit there with my eyes closed for 30 minutes. I had such bad anxiety that I just, and I didn't want to open my eyes because I felt like I had to have my eyes closed to be meditating. And so I would just sit there and just tolerate the anxiety, the fear. I had this feeling that someone would come in with a bat and like smack me over the head, or something bad was going to happen to me if I, you know, all this, really what it was is all this traumatic stress, this fear that I experienced from when I was a kid. And one of the things that was so valuable is hearing the Dharma talk after the meditation. Because it felt like what I heard Dave teaching was something that I already knew. Buddhism to me felt familiar. I didn't feel like I was being asked to believe anything. Nothing really felt like, at least the way that he taught, it didn't feel like a stretch. I didn't feel like I had to be like, well, maybe, I don't know about that. Everything felt very practical. And I started to have a little bit of faith that, okay, well, maybe there's something to this. There's something about the Buddha and his teaching about dukkha. This word dukkha means dissatisfaction or disjointedness or distress. That we, in life, experience, as the Chinese Buddhists say, 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. We have gain and loss and praise and blame and pleasure and pain. And we can't seem to get just the pleasure and the gain and the praise. That life has both of these ends of these extremes, right? That it's not just one way. That I really wanted to find, and I was really searching for something out here, something that I could find a place where I wouldn't be so depressed, where I wouldn't feel so alone, where I wouldn't feel so afraid. And what's the fucking thing? Because I would look around at everyone else and I'd say, why do you guys seem to be okay with this whole being a human thing? Because this is terrible for me. That's what my experience was like. And I realized and was validated through the Buddhist teaching that, yeah, this is really, that being a human is inherently this word vulnere, where we get the word vulnerability, means that we're susceptible to woundedness, that we are open and exposed to change, that we're exposed to loss. The Buddhist truth of birth, aging, sickness, and death, these are definitely going to happen. And so how do we live a meaningful life knowing that life is changing, that life is insecure, not stable? And I felt like for the first time, I talked about this a little bit this morning, but I felt like the first time in my life I wasn't being lied to. I went to a Catholic high school, and I'm not shitting on Catholicism. I think there are some aspects of it that I personally enjoy, but I remember going to my religion teachers and just being like, why do we do this thing during Mass? And they're like, I don't know, you just do it. Like, why do you believe in, you know, this thing and the Bible? You know, there wasn't really this practical, sequential kind of process that I had been looking for. And with Buddhism, it just felt natural. It's like, oh yeah, I know that. They call it the wisdom of dissatisfaction. Yeah, I know that it's hard, that my humanity, that being a human being, is hard. And so developed this faith. It's like, okay, I sat last week for 30 minutes and I was able to tolerate my anxiety, and I went in the next week and I was able to do it, and maybe if I continue to sit with my anxiety, something will happen. I don't know what, but I know I can do it. So even just that little bit in those first few groups gave me a tremendous amount of faith. I was like, oh shit, I sat for 30 minutes. I remember bragging to my friends and telling them, yeah, I sit in meditation for 30 minutes. They're like, oh my gosh, what do you do? I didn't tell him how miserable it was, you know, but that built some confidence. And so then I was determined. I had this determination, this effort. Okay, I can do this, and I want to actually try to do this a little bit more often. So I started coming, and eventually Dave moved the class to 2 times a week on Wednesday and Sunday. I would come both on Wednesday and Sunday. I would go to him after the class and I would ask him questions about, you know, Buddhism and the meditation. I would write down his meditation instructions secretly. I'd go home, I'd try to meditate at home, and I'd hold him out in front of me, or I'd put him on the ground. I'd just kind of like look at the meditation instruction, and I'd try to practice it. And then I'd look at the meditation instruction and try to practice it. You know, and this practice has actually changed everything about the way that I view my own humanity, the ways in which I suffer. I started to get a little bit more space from my mind. I saw what it was up week after week. I went and I sat and I got really familiar with my mind, which is one of the most beneficial aspects of this practice for me, is that I started to know my own mind. It was like out here, a friend that I could see, or sometimes an enemy, but it was a frequent visitor. I started to see the different flavors of my own fear and obsession and my comparing mind, my critical mind. Brené Brown calls this the inner hustler. She says the part of the brain that's trying to compare, improve, compete, outperform. I started to see all of the tricks. And so we can start to, I developed some faith that I can start to operate beyond this type of conditioning, this type of habit. Because in Buddhism, what I learned later was that all of these behaviors that I did in early recovery, these esteemable acts, trying to be more honest in my speech and showing up to work on time, and you know, that all of those things, that in Buddhism, thinking is a behavior. If you are worrying, you're going to get really good at worrying. If you obsess, you're going to get really good at obsession. And so I started to look at what my mind was doing, actively participating in, we call this volitional thinking. I started to look at what my mind was doing and to be able to redirect it and be like, shit, I don't want to do that. I don't want to play that story out, the poor me, the I'm worthless, I'm hopeless story out anymore. I want to do something else with my thoughts. So I started to learn not only to have more space, more familiarity with my mind, but actually how to train my mind to think differently. And so what I just kind of went through and what I maybe want to open up for discussion, I'll touch on, tease these out a little bit more, is these five spiritual faculties or these five supportive faculties that the Buddha offers: faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And three of these that, reflecting on my retreat, that have really stuck out as essential or foundational for building and developing wisdom, to breaking free from our mental habits and behavioral patterns that aren't serving us anymore. Three of these that are really important: faith, effort, and mindfulness. Faith is something I think gets overlooked a whole lot in Buddhism. And again, I talked about this morning, because it's a non-theistic practice. There's no devotion to some being. God is not, you know, from the salvation model in Buddhism, it's not going to save you. That we each have to do the work ourselves to free ourselves from suffering. That it takes effort. You know, that we have to show up and we have to be interested in what is causing so much stress and distress in here. We have to do the work of looking at our mind time and time again and training ourselves and practicing behaviors that lead towards more ease and well-being. We have to do that. You know, but there's also a need for something to feel like can support us. Because I've been told that I'm compulsively self-reliant. And this happens to a lot of Buddhist practitioners, where it's like, no gods, no masters, you know, be a light unto yourself. The Buddha said it himself. I don't need all y'all. You know, I don't need any of this shit. You know, and really what we do is we need to have some faith. We need to have refuge. We need to have a place of shelter. Some encouragement. On the retreat that I sat, I'll tell you all a little bit about it. It's a 21 days silent meditation retreat. And when I showed up to the retreat center, a lot of the retreatants had already been there for a month. And so I showed up at this kind of weird time. No one spoke English when I arrived. I mean, people spoke English there. So they just circled on the map where my room was, and they told me to show up to this place. So I just kind of like jumped into this retreat. It was from 3 in the morning, you woke up, and you went to bed at 10 at night, and you practiced formally in mindfulness, sitting, walking, meditation, hour periods of time, 16 to 18 hours a day for 21 days. And so there's just like, here you are. Here's the structure. Here's the format. See ya later. You know, I hope it works out. That's what it felt like in the beginning. And one of the things that is so beautiful about having gone on retreat is like I had some resource. I had faith. It's like, I fucking got this shit. If it don't work out, I'll go lay in my bed and suffer for an hour or two, and that will pass. You know, and I had faith also in these people that were teaching the retreat. There were these monastics, these monks that had dedicated their lives to this path of practice. They believed in it so much, they were willing to renounce all of their material possessions for one or two robes, shave their head off, except only food that people offered or put in their bowl every day. Imagine not picking your food or asking or ordering something that you want for 40 years because someone's making an offering because they want to support you, because people in the community believe so much and have so much faith in this path of practice that they come from the village to feed these monks. And so I could look at all this and be like, man, maybe... you know, maybe there's something that I can really take refuge in here. Maybe these guys know when my mind is in its most doubting, confused, trying to talk me into how much a plane ticket back would be, or I could just go hang out in Myanmar for 2 weeks. You know, to be able to turn my mind towards this faith, this trust, this confidence in this path of practice. And for a lot of us, I think it's important to admit that I think so many of us struggle with faith because things that we have had faith in have been so disappointing. Which is a little bit paradoxical because that's kind of what the Buddha's saying. It's like, yeah, you've been having faith in kind of the wrong things. Yeah. And so how do we develop faith? And I won't talk about this because I did this morning, but traditionally, if you want to look into it, there are these three refuges. One is faith and refuge in the Buddha. That one way of looking at this, someone has done it before me. Someone has taken this path, and maybe they were fully liberated, whatever the hell that means. If I believe in that, maybe they just led a more meaningful, easeful, peaceful life. Maybe I just believe in like their message, so I can have faith and refuge in that. But really what this means is that the potential for my own awakening, that I have everything I need internally to wake up. I have faith in that. Faith in refuge in the Dharma, in this path of practice, this holistic path of speech, action, livelihood, training my behavior, of cultivating and developing mindfulness for the purpose of having more wisdom and insight, that I can have faith in this path and this practice. And then the third is I can have faith and take refuge in the community, in a sense of people to connect with. And this faith, when we really develop this or practice this, it naturally builds into effort, because then I'm motivated. Right? Then we develop courage, this sense of like, I'm willing to really, like going on a retreat takes courage, your first retreat, or coming here to sit a half day. We're going to sit for practice meditation for 4 hours. I remember going to my first day meditation retreat. And again, kind of humble bragging to my friend, what did you do today? 6 hours I practiced meditation. You know, and that, like, having and putting in the effort and really doing the practice, because I have faith, I'm willing to show up and do it, and to have the courage to do it time and time again. Maya Angelou has this beautiful quote. She said, courage is the most of all of the virtues, because without courage, you can't do any other virtue consistently. She says, you can be anything erratically, kind, just, right? But you can't, to do that thing time and time again depends on courage. And this is really, the Buddha talked about effort more than any other path factor. In all of the discourses, if you go through them, he talked about effort more than anything else. I mean, if one of the things that I got from this retreat, they gave a talk, like I'm doing tonight, every night of the retreat, and it was always on effort. It became something that I kind of laughed about internally. I was like, oh, I would joke with myself, oh, I wonder what we're going to hear about tonight, compassion or, you know, community, or always on just fucking wake up at 3 a.m. and just be present every moment until the time you go to bed. Because these teachers had so much faith and they just wanted to encourage you to do the practice. They're like, you go sit in the interview, you're here for 3 weeks. They would say, you're only here for 3 weeks. I think 3 months is better. You can extend, they would tell me. You can extend. You can stay. We can help you extend. Every time I went in for an interview, you can extend. And it really became this very sweet thing. It's like when someone invites you over to their house and they, you know, don't have anywhere to be, and they offer you tea and you sit down and you're like, okay, you feel like you should be going, you know, and they're like, no, stay. There was that feeling of like, we want you here. And we want you every moment to just practice mindfulness, because the potential of this practice is beyond what, you know, our limiting view and perspective can see a lot of the time. And so with effort naturally arises mindfulness, right? Which is the ability to observe our direct experience without judging it. That every moment that I say, okay, where's my attention, is a moment that naturally mindfulness can arise. Oh, yeah, where is my attention? What is going on? Mindfulness repeated one moment after another moment builds into concentration. Because now I can actually focus. I remember the first time practicing where I started to recognize that my mind didn't wander, you know, a millisecond at a time, jumping between a million different things. I actually was able to get like 5 seconds, 10 seconds of some peace, of being able to, you know, be with my breath and feel the breath. It's like, oh man, that feels good. And you can get that sense, right? When you, even if you're new to meditation, there are those times where it's like, oh man, I didn't really even have many thoughts there for a couple moments. There was some spaciousness in my mind. And out of that spaciousness, we're able to see the mind directly and clearly. The development of wisdom naturally arises. So such a weird thing. This all starts with faith. Faith naturally leads into effort. Effort naturally leads into mindfulness. Mindfulness naturally develops into concentration. And concentration, through all of these other factors, help support our development of wisdom, insight. So I don't know where we're at with all that, but those are some thoughts, and I just wanted to share some of my experience. But we have about 10 minutes, so we just want to open it up for discussion. Again, the encouragement is just for anyone to share. You don't have to be an expert of anything other than your own experience. So you're encouraged. If you feel called to share, you would like to share something, please do. We do want folks to use I, me, my. You know, we want to refrain from talking to other people or sharing advice with other people. So just sharing about your personal experience is good. So we'll open it up. Thank you.